Just recently, we found out that there are more than 30 million terrorists hiding in Canada. You are one of them. So from now on, we will record all your activities for 6 months. Who you call and when. When you use your cell phone and where. When and where you access the internet and what sites you are visiting. Who you write emails to and why. And because you are a terrorist, CSIS is allowed to investigate your computer. We know your passwords. We can look at your pictures. We can see who you are chatting with or browse through your documents. We can download all the files from your computer, change them, or save completely new files. There hasn't been a single internationally planned terrorist attack in Canada. But with you and the other 30 million terrorists, we have to be careful that this doesn't change. A new ID that digitally stores DNA, more surveillance cameras, and many, many more surprises are already on their way to you. Because you are a terrorist.
This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 4 for Thursday, November 19th, 2009. This week, Verizon starts sending out RIAA notices. The UK reduces 3 strikes to only 2. And can the DNA of your relatives implicate you in a crime?
So this is this crazy thing that, in fact, Canada's signing up to. You know, we just found out that Tony Clement's been in this secret meeting on a copyright treaty that will bring in this 3 strikes rule. And the way that 3 strikes rules work is if you or anyone in your house is accused of violating copyright 3 times without any proof, without any evidence, without a judge, without a lawyer, and 3 accusations, we take away your internet access for you and everyone in your house. And we put your name on a national registry of people for whom it's a crime to provide internet access. So no ISP can give you internet access. And that means that your kid can't do her homework. It means you can't keep in touch with your family overseas. It means you can't earn your living if part of your living comes from the net. All that stuff disappears because you might, without any proof, have violated copyright.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture, knowledge, control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And the intro piece I did today, it's called You Are a Terrorist, and this is Canadian version. I ran across this on YouTube, and it's adapted from a German version, so I changed a couple things. So if you want to check out the original version, it does have English subtitles. You just go to dubistterrorist.de/en, and you can get that link in the Pirate Party Radio forums if you don't know what I'm saying, because it is in German. dubistterrorist.de/en, and you can get to their website, and they'll have a link on there for the video in German. And after that, it was Cory Doctorow on a Canadian television show called The Hour, and it was just a short excerpt and him talking about the 3 strikes law that is trying to be implemented all over the world in secret that we discussed on previous shows, so reference those previous shows. And we have some incoming messages from people regarding past shows. This was sent in by Anonymous. I'm protecting his name. And this is regarding the body scanners on episode number 2. He says, sorry if you've already had people chime in about this, as it was in episode 2, but people who work at the airport aren't just Mr. Joe Blow. Well, not completely. Having the job before, I would give you some inside info. To get on to working at the airport as an airport screener, that is normally done by CATSA, Canadian Air Transport Security Authority, contracts a security company, normally Garda, G-A-R-D-A, that hires people and then does a background check. First, there are two types of passes. Basically, it has been a while, so bear with my memory. A temporary pass is issued after passing a security clearance check to ensure that there's no criminal background or outstanding charges pending or warrants for arrest. And that's kind of a usual thing for a job. Next, you're fingerprinted, and most airports use an eye scan to complement the fingerprinting. Second type is a red pass, except they are scheduled for an intense background check that takes on average to complete 3 to 6 months for somebody born in the country with Canadian parents that have their citizenship for someone that doesn't travel a lot. For some people, it takes up to 2 years to get a red pass based on clearance to work there without being scanned. Until you get a red pass, you are scanned like any other passenger constantly and cannot move up the chain from checking boarding passes or putting people clothes in bins. After you move up the chain and get your red pass, you go through staff screening, which has a mandatory pass and a retinal eye check and possible random screening, the same as everyone else except in a separate area. Then you can move up the line to other jobs like wanding people after they go through metal detectors, X-ray viewer, and EDT monitor, explosive detection trace. But as of when I was there, EDT was the last in line for jobs. Last line for the line jobs. Now I'm assuming some here, but I would assume that if it was done by CATSA, Garda, that it would be after you experienced everywhere else because the airport has this type of system with everything. Though from the wording of the article, when it talks about randomly second checks being done on people, this is normally done by a customs officer who's appointed peace officer through the criminal code. So I hope this clears up that not anyone can get that job. So it does sound like there's quite a graduated process to getting to working on the scanners and seeing people pretty much naked as they pass through. This next one's from Prodigy, and this is also regarding the body scanners in episode 2. He says, I actually went through one of these when I was coming back through Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. It's required there. No choice, no pat-downs, just a scan. It's not really as invasive as it sounds. Your body is shown up as a big blue thing, and it basically looks like a quick mock-up in Maya, which is a 3D rendering program. I don't mind it so much as it is illegal for any of those machines to log data there, and it really does stand out if you're hiding a gun on your person. Even though a metal detector works fine, super hard plastic knives can still slip through those things. Though really, if you tried to hijack an airplane with a single knife around here, you'd have 7 guys sitting on the dude before he could make it to the cockpit. This next one's from G. Bliss regarding DRM and download-only video games. This was from something I posed in episode 3. I completely and totally agree about the check-in aspect of DRM software on video games. I actually experienced a bit of this personally. I was a gigantic fan of a computer game called Freelancer back in the day. I recently came back to it and tried to go online and see if any of the communities I knew and loved from my childhood were still kicking around. But no matter what I did, I could not connect to the Microsoft server list. I later learned that Microsoft had shut down the server for cost analysis reasons, and that a fan had taken it upon himself to make a brand new one in its place. I can't imagine what will happen to people when the creators of Spore, or anyone who copies their DRM strategy, goes out of business. So luckily, obviously in that case, somebody stepped up to the plate and is running a game server in place of the one that was shut down by Microsoft. But, you know, sometimes it might be impossible if they don't share their source code, and then you're out of luck for these online exclusive online games that you can't play one player with. And my question of the week this week is, have you or anyone you know ever had to deal with a no to sent by the RIAA or MPAA or, you know, SOCAN or any body that represents musicians or movie industry sent a notice of shutdown to you or warning to you. Personally, I have never been sent that notice. It might be a bit more prevalent in the United States or in other countries, but I have known people to be sent those notices by their ISP, but only warnings. I've never heard of anybody being shut down or kicked off the internet. So if you or anybody you know has had those warnings or gone past like the initial stages, send an email to me. Just go to the PirateParty.radio.com website and drop me a line. Now in the news, Verizon tests sending out RIA copyright notices, speaking of which. This was sent in by Sabriel. Customers of Verizon Communications who pirate music files may soon receive an unwelcome letter from the company. Verizon, the second largest phone company in the United States, is expecting to begin issuing copyright notices on behalf of the Recording Industry Association of America to those accused of illegally downloading songs from the web, according to sources with knowledge of the agreement. The sources who asked for anonymity said Verizon's letter campaign is part of a test, which is expected to begin Thursday. Jonathan Lamy, an RIA spokesman confirmed the existence of the test but declined further comment. The move is significant for the music industry because among internet service providers, Verizon has typically been among the most reluctant to intervene in copyright cases on behalf of entertainment companies. We recognize the importance of copyright and the need to enforce those copyrights, a Verizon spokesman said in a statement to CNET. Without that enforcement, intellectual property won't be generated at all. At the same time, it's important for our customers to be assured that they won't have their privacy rights trampled. And the letter the RIA will send to Verizon, and will likely be forwarded to customers, is similar to those issued in the past by other ISPs, such as AT&T, Comcast, and Cox Communications. The RIA letter has typically notified customers that they have been accused of illegally sharing songs and informed them that such activity is illegal. In the letter, the user is advised to delete the content they distribute. It's important to note that not included in the letter are threats of service termination or interruptions, or any talk of graduated response. That's the term the RIA used to describe a deterrent program whereby an ISP gradually ratchets up penalties or warnings to suspected file sharers. Last December, the RIA announced that it would no longer seek to file new lawsuits against individuals accused of illegal file sharing. Instead, the trade group represents the four largest music labels would try to convince ISPs to adopt a graduated response program. While some companies, such as Cox, said that they will terminate service for chronic copyright violators, most ISPs shied away from suggesting service termination. More importantly, in the 11 months since the RIAA dropped the filing of lawsuits on a widespread basis, not a single ISP has acknowledged a formal agreement with the RIAA. As for Verizon, it appears the company is expanding the anti-piracy relationships it has with the entertainment sector. In past years, as many of its competitors begin to lock arms with entertainment companies, Verizon appears to hold back. Verizon fought the RIAA when the group went to court to force the ISPs to turn over the name of an alleged copyright violator. Verizon also opposed anti-piracy legislation important to film and music sectors. Verizon's attitude towards anti-piracy seems to change in 2005, when the company quietly agreed to forward notices to suspected illegal file sharers on behalf of Disney. In exchange, Verizon received the rights to transmit 12 of Disney's TV channels over its broadband network. Several other ISPs have recently begun forwarding copyright notices on behalf of film studios, according to sources who spoke to CNET. It's not yet clear which other ISPs are involved. Now, up to that point in the story, you wonder where the advantage is for Verizon to forward these copyright notifications to its customers as an ISP. Like, what would they gain for an advantage? And also, further to that, what would they gain for an advantage to eventually shutting down these people? And you can actually see there that they really don't have any monetary advantage for shutting down customers, because obviously they would lose that customer and word of mouth would spread, and they would get a bad reputation among their customers. But as you can see, these ISPs, especially the major ones, belong to huge conglomerates that are not just ISPs, but content providers. And they're essentially, I'm drawing an analogy here, that it looks like they're being blackmailed almost behind the scenes, because it says they were given the rights to transmit 12 of Disney's TV channels over its broadband network. And I'm sure that may not have happened if they didn't agree to send out these notifications. It doesn't say that, of course, but you know, it goes hand in hand that one scratches the other's back. Next door, the UK government plans two strikes for file sharers instead of three. This was sent in by Greg Universe and Epics. The UK government will now only send one warning letter to those accused of illegal file sharing before it implements technical measures that include internet disconnection. This is from ZeroPay.com. UK Business Secretary Lord Mandelson and his Department for Business, Innovations and Skills has apparently been quite successful in lobbying for legislation to implement its evolved measures for tackling illegal file sharing. So successful, in fact, that a three strikes, i.e. two warning letters followed by internet disconnection, graduated response system has been dropped to a mere two. That means accused illegal file sharers will get a single warning before being locked out of the so-called information superhighway. The government said it will warn people at first, but if it proves insufficient, it will begin disconnecting people beginning in the spring of 2011. It's good news for fans of British music that government is now introducing legislation to tackle illegal downloading, says Jeff Taylor, chief executive for the British phonographic industry. The chief sector in the UK needs new measurements implemented urgently that address this problem for now, and the future in the UK is to lead Europe in giving consumers innovative and high-quality digital entertainment. Mandelson feels that the current timetable, which stands at 2 to 3 years for a 70% reduction using a combination of notifications and technical measures, would take an unacceptable amount of time to complete in a situation that calls for urgent action. The Open Rights Group, a UK-based group of people who aims to preserve digital rights and freedoms, have roundly criticized the proposal and notes the copyright infringement accusations can only be made against a connection and not an individual. Appeals mechanisms may be appropriate when it's clear that evidence is robust and the punishment is clear, but with this proposal, neither is true, it says. Evidence cannot show who may infringe copyright, only what connection was used. And the punishment could have an enormous range of effects, from being disruptive to removing somebody's ability to earn a living. It adds that three strikes is not a silver bullet to end piracy, and that a better plan is to encourage copyright holders to meet consumer demands. It cites South Korea as an example of what three strikes really means. After becoming the first country to threaten accused file sharers with internet disconnection this past July, copyright holders are still finding that rampant piracy exists. They've now decided to ratchet up the battle even further by warning all peer-to-peer sites that to install filters preventing users from uploading copyrighted material by the end of the year or face stern legal measures. Even that will be an effort in futility, and file sharers will simply turn to alternatives as they always have and always will. And that is so very true. It's never going to stop the people. There's always a lust for music and entertainment, and the easier to get that, the easiest way to get that is where people are going to be drawn, and the most versatile way for people to play these types of music and movies is going to be the one that people are gravitating towards. If DRM is going to continue to lock down movies and music so that the companies control what you do with their product, people aren't going to want that product anymore, and they're going to go to other products that are free from digital rights management and free from these restrictions, so that they can put it on all 10 of their players, so that if they're in the car, or if they're going for a jog, or if they're at home, if they're going to play it on one computer in the house, or they're going to play it on another computer in the house. it's up for the up to the consumer. The consumer is the one who makes the decisions. It's not the corporations who make the final decisions. And that's where they've got to learn that consumers are going to be the ones ending up deciding. It's not about the legislation that's passed. It's about where the money is going. And if the corporations want the money in their pocket, they're going to have to make some concessions to come closer to what the ideas of the consumer has of the ideal way to consume their music and movies. And in the UK, they're planning to take away the internet, but in Spain, they're planning to make it a right, just like Finland announced last month. Spain codifies the right to broadband, and this is from PCMag.com. Spanish citizens will have a legal right from 2011 to be able to buy broadband internet of at least 1 megabyte per second at a regulated price wherever they live, the country's industry minister said on Tuesday. The telecoms operator holding the so-called universal service contract would have to guarantee it could offer reasonably priced broadband throughout Spain, said Miguel Sebastian in a statement sent to media. Former state monopoly Telefonica has always held the universal contract aim at protecting consumers in poorly populated areas from being cut off in cases where operators would otherwise consider providing the service unprofitable. The service also subsidized telecoms to disabled users. Until now, the universal service has only guaranteed internet via phone line, fixed telephone, directory service, and telephone booths. Earlier this month, Spain's telecom regulator, the CMT, proposed that Telefonica, Vodafone, and Orange foot the cost of providing the universal service for 2006, which it judged had cost €75.34 million, with Telefonica paying 71% of the costs. Adding internet to the universal service would increase the future cost of the universal service. That's awkwardly worded. The yearly calculations of the cost of the service will take about 2 years to complete. Consumer group FACUA said it welcomed that broadband internet would finally be a right, but said the speed was insufficient and the measure should be introduced before 2011. FACUA calls on the minister to speed up the measure, increase the speed, and to set a reasonable price, the organization said in a statement. So that's a good step forward for the spread of access to information in Spain. And I know a lot of people in the United States and in other countries, mostly outside of Europe, are asking for the same thing. People are in rural areas where there's just not the high-speed broadband access that they need, and even they have to normally go over telephone lines. And really, there's a lot of countries, and I've seen this debated back and forth, there's a lot of countries that have equal population density of the United States and Canada that have it broadband almost throughout the whole area, and even way faster than that is available for the United States. So that's a good step forward for Spain. The next story was sent in by Weondi. Network enjoyed by police and citizens alike no longer available. This is off of DailyTech.com. The MPAA turns its quest against file sharing from suing individual citizens to taking down a municipal Wi-Fi service. Municipal Wi-Fi services, community-maintained telecommunication services, have become a popular trend across the country as they bring free service or lower prices, as well as faster connections sometimes. However, they are unpopular among telecoms, who have long enjoyed the benefits of exclusivity to justify expensive service plans and copyright protection organizations that feel municipal Wi-Fi networks create a haven for piracy. Coshocton, Ohio has a thriving free municipal Wi-Fi program. Then one user made the mistake of downloading a movie illegally off a torrent site. Kind of hard to make a mistake of doing that. You'd have to make a couple of mistake clicks to do that. Which Sony Pictures MPAA copyright enforcement team caught wind of. The county's internet service provider, One Community, was subsequently notified, and the Information Technology Department was then notified by One Community that the offender needed to be found or the service would be ended. Elizabeth Kaltman, vice president of the corporate communications with the MPAA, said municipal Wi-Fi are spreading the evils of piracy across America. She states, piracy on municipal Wi-Fi networks is a very, very common occurrence across U.S. in towns big or small. Citizens are used to instant access and instant gratifications. They have the philosophy, if it's there, I can take it. She suggests that law-abiding citizens use on-demand services from services like Netflix and Blockbuster, Disney Video, Fox On Demand, Cartoon Network. She also suggests citizens check out the MPAA website for a full list of legal options. She says citizens should remember the MPAA will aggressively pursue cases of piracy and that fines can be as high as $150,000 or more. She states, "We target piracy at its source. We really focus on keeping the product out of the market in the first place." For Coshocton's residents, though, the MPA is no friend. The community is now without its Wi-Fi that approximately 100 residents at any given time were relying on. Police no longer can make incident reports as seamlessly, and vendors can't verify customers' credit cards as easy without an affordable wireless solution. Mike Levine, the city's IT director, said they would love to implement a solution to block piracy, but that would be prohibitively expensive given the program's scant budget. He estimates that the cost would be approximately $2,900 to implement, $2,000 for the equipment, then $900 annually for the filtering program. While the MPA's legal bill for killing the service surely eclipses this, they appear more content to kill the service rather than fund such protections. The city is investigating the incident and trying to find out who downloaded the movie in a last-ditch effort to save their now-shuttered network. I find it amazing to believe that a corporation can disable the internet for a town. That it's unbelievable to me that a private corporation can walk into a town and say your citizens don't have access to Wi-Fi anymore because we're sending this notification to you saying that somebody somewhere downloaded one movie. Now, the greater good is not outweighed by this one movie. And now the citizens that used to enjoy something that was provided by the town that they pay their taxes to, is now shut down. It's very sad. I believe that this story was blown a little out of proportion. It is only one portion of the town that is shut down. It's not the whole town. But it's the implications that are far-reaching and that can be expanded upon and applied to many towns across the country in the same manner. NARA, N-A-R-A, admits violating internal policy on personal information. This is from FCW.com. Agency violated its security policy when it returned defective hard drives from record systems to vendors. The National Archives and Records Administration in the U.S. violated its information security policies by returning failed hard drives from systems containing personally identifiable information of current government employees and military veterans back to vendors. By agency policy, NARA is supposed to destroy hard drives rather than return them, according to a top NARA official. However, the agency believes that there was no disclosure of personally identifiable information, despite the violations of its own policy, said NARA, the then acting archivist Adrian Thomas. Thomas told the House Oversight and Government Reform Committees of Information Policy, Census and National Archives Subcommittee, November 5th, that on two separate occasions, the agency sent defective disk drives back to vendors under a maintenance contract rather than destroying and disposing of them in-house. Today, the Senate confirmed David Farino as the head of the agency. Meanwhile, during the hearing, Thomas said senior NARA officials recently discovered the agency had returned a hard drive from a system designed to digitize the office official personnel files of current government employees. The system is believed to have contained files on employees from NARA, the General Services Administration, and the Office of Personnel Management when the drive was returned to the vendor in April, she said. Thomas said that the agencies had been notified. Earlier, a similar violation of NARA policy happened when officials sent away a defective drive from a system the agency uses to track the more than 1 million requests for veterans records it gets annually. To ask for a record, veterans must provide information such as date and place of birth, branch and duration of service, social security number and/or service number, and the date and place of medical treatment. Thomas said that in both instances, the drives were returned under existing contracts that contained privacy protections. However, she said that since those contracts had been signed, NARA's policy had changed to prohibit the return of failed drives. That non-return policy, put in place or in summer of 2008, was broken in both cases, she said. So this is another example of our privacy being violated by the government because of careless information, disregard for information policies and privacy policies. This is extremely frightening, since the amount of data that's being collected and stored on systems out there in the government or even the private sector is increasingly recording more and more information about us as we mostly are willingly giving it up, such as places like Facebook and other, you know, social networking sites. And even as we move into the, as we have moved into the digital age, regarding the government and having to provide data information to the government through the internet or as they're stored at the government, and they're increasingly losing these drives and leaving them around in computers that are unsecured for some reason. And it's very distressing. Here's another one in the same vein. AG investigates Blue Cross Blue Shield data breach, and this is from darkreading.com. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal is investigating Blue Cross Blue Shield's loss of confidential information, including tax identification and social security numbers, for 800,000 healthcare providers nationwide. The Attorney General is also seeking additional identity theft protection for affected doctors, therapists, and other professionals, according to a statement from the Attorney General issued last week. Blue Cross Blue Shield and its affiliates have violated state law by losing the information and failing to notify providers in a timely manner, the AG states. The companies are offering professionals 1 year of identity theft protection, but Blumenthal said the measures are inadequate and unacceptable, demanding at least 2 years of protection. And Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, one of the targeted companies, said it will extend credit monitoring for 2 years for affected providers. The companies lost the information when a laptop was stolen August 25th. The computer held information on the company's providers nationwide, including names, addresses, tax identification, and provider numbers, and some social security numbers. The theft affected providers nationwide, but the Connecticut AG is investigating on behalf of 18,817 of its Connecticut healthcare providers. Blue Cross Blue Shield and its related companies, Anthem and Empire, failed to inform healthcare providers until late last month, AG said. We are vigorously investigating this appalling data loss, needlessly exposing more than 18,000 Connecticut doctors and professionals to devastating identity theft, Blumenthal said in a statement. Failing to promptly notify providers of breach is inexcusable and a possible violation of state law. Waiting 2 months left providers severely at risk, needlessly and irresponsibly exposing them to financial mayhem. Blumenthal added, my office demands a full accounting from Blue Cross Blue Shield, healthcare providers affected, details of the loss, protections from professionals, policies and procedures for data loss and other information. State law mandates that companies fully secure sensitive personal information and quickly disclose breaches, laws the companies may have broken. So this is another distressing story about data loss. And the most appalling part of this story is that it was from a laptop. And why information like this is being stored on a laptop is beyond me. Something that it can be left out in the open, could be left in a car, rather than be securely transferred from a data room to another data room over secure encrypted networks is appalling. It's unbelievable that at this day and age, after so many stories over so many years have come out of data loss, that people are still transporting sensitive, unencrypted data on laptops that could be lost or stolen at a moment's notice. And they are. They're constantly. I see these stories constantly in the news. And I don't understand why it keeps going on. And it must be due to costs, keeping costs low. because transporting it on a laptop is easier and quicker rather than making sure that they have a secure data network from one branch to another branch. The next story is about privacy as well, but the privacy of yourself. This was titled, Using Relatives' DNA Cracks Crime, but Privacy Questions Are Raised. This is from CNN.com. Using DNA to catch criminals have become common, but police in Denver, Colorado this year demonstrated how the practice can be taken to a new level. They tracked down a suspect not through his DNA, but through that of his brother. Here's how it happened. The Denver District Attorney's Office said, in February 2008, two cars were broken into. Police found blood at both scenes and ran the samples through DNA databases, but they couldn't find a match. Then, as part of a study being conducted by the district attorney's office, investigators used new software to see whether the DNA in the blood was close enough to potentially be from a family member of somebody in the criminal DNA database. The software came up with six potential matches. Five didn't pan out, but one led to police to a convicted car thief and ultimately that man's brother, Louis James James Tenagero pleaded guilty in September to one count of criminal trespass and received a sentence of 2 years probation. Attempts to contact this person for a report were unsuccessful. District Attorney Mitch Morrissey called one of the first cases in the country to use software to find familiar DNA matches. Our hope here is to show that it works, which we have done. He said, I think it's a valuable way to generate leads. Morrissey's office developed the software tool with the Denver police, he said. He hopes to use it to solve murders, rapes, and cold cases. The matches to family members won't be used as evidence itself, he said, but rather as a way to generate leads for investigators to explore, similar to the way police may use a witness report of a partial license plate. There's no reason to bring this into court. You use the science, you use the DNA, then you use the conventional investigation. The bad guy abandoned the DNA at the crime scene. They have no expectation of privacy, Denver District Attorney Mitch Morrissey. But some privacy advocates are crying foul. Family members have done nothing wrong to get in the database, said Maryland Defense Attorney Stephen Mercer. And this is an example of the web of suspicion of people who have committed offenses being widened to include their entire family. Mercer has been fighting familiar DNA searches since 2003. He was part of an effort that led Maryland to being the first state to outlaw familiar DNA searches. People have a reasonable expectation of privacy of their DNA. It's a basic violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Morrissey disagrees. I've yet to hear anyone explain how this is a violation of the U.S. Constitution. The bad guy abandoned the DNA at the crime scene. They have no expectation of privacy. Mercer also argued that even though the technique may be successful in certain cases, that doesn't mean it's worth potential infringements on constitutional rights. If they want to drive down the street and do no-knock searches of homes, they would catch bad guys. But at what cost to our society? Morrissey hopes to have his office's familial DNA study completed sometime in the coming year. In Colorado, the criminal DNA database includes people convicted of felonies. In the fall of 2010, Colorado will be taking DNA samples at the time the person is charged with a felony. If the person is found not guilty, or if the charges are dropped, he or she can request to have the samples removed from the database. Mercer said that it's a slippery slope. Where it leads is towards the development of a universal database from the time they are born, he says. They want everyone in the database. Now, I've talked to DNA experts in Canada, and they said this is illegal in Canada, and they don't use this type of DNA matching in Canada because of the privacy violations that it could incur. And the last statement really says it all. It is a slippery slope where the government is wanting to create a full database on everybody from the time they're born to the time they die. And seeing from past stories how that information can fall into the wrong hands. And this is information of people who are innocent, people who have never been convicted of a crime. This and they said they're trying to get information on people's DNA when they're being arrested. And this can be done quite easily, and anybody can be arrested on suspicion of something, and then the charges drop later. And especially if you're doing a peaceful protest, they can round up everybody, take their DNA, and release them with no charges. And some people don't know that their DNA is entered into a database, and this database can you can ask for it to be expunged of your DNA. And eventually, you know, they'll get everybody used to having their DNA in these databases, and people can ask for it to be taken out. And then eventually they'll just push it to say, well, why take it out? We don't need to take it out. We'll just have it there on record, but we won't be able to allow to use it at any time unless they get convicted again. And we'll just have it on reserve. And then it just a slippery slope further and further along until everybody's used to this criminal society that everybody is being watched at all times, and we just push it further and further, and it's just frightening. This next story is about a collection of data as well on privacy. But this is by using your power through your electrical power. This is very interesting, the implications that this poses. Now, I wouldn't have thought of this right away, but, you know, some smart people out there are really thinking about this. Smart grid poses privacy risks, and this is from the Washington Post. Technologists are already worried about the security implications of linking nearly all elements of the U.S. power grid to the public internet. Now, privacy experts are warning that the so-called smart grid efforts could usher in a new class of concerns as utilities begin collecting more granular data about consumers' daily power consumption. The modernization of the grid will increase the level of personal information detail available, as well as the instances of collection, use, and disclosure of personal information, warns a report jointly released Tuesday by the Ontario Information and Privacy Commissioner and the Future of Privacy Forum, a think tank made up of chief privacy officers, advocates, and academics. Smart grid technology, including new smart meters being attached to businesses and homes, is designed in part to provide consumers with real-time feedback on power consumption patterns and levels. But as these systems begin to come online, it remains unclear how utilities and partner companies will mine, share, and use that new wealth of information, experts warn. Instead of measuring energy use at the end of each billing cycle, smart meters will provide this information at much shorter intervals, the report notes. Even if electricity use is not recorded minute by minute or at the application appliance level, the information may be gleaned from ongoing monitor of electrical consumption as the appropriate number of occupants, when they're present, and as well as when they're awake or asleep. For many, this will resonate as a sanctity of the home issue, such as intimate details of daily life should not be accessible. According to the study, examples of information that utilities and partner companies might be able to glean from more granular power consumption data include whether or not how often exercise equipment is used, whether a house has an alarm system, and how often it's activated, when the occupants usually shower, and how often they wash their clothes. Other privacy risks could result in a combination of information from two separate users of the smart grid. For example, roaming smart grid devices such as electrical vehicles, recharging at a friend's or acquaintance houses, could create or reveal additional personal information. At a recent smart grid conference in Madrid, FPF co-chair Jules Polonensky showed how researchers have already mapped unique load patterns off different equipment, showing that, for instance, washing machines pull power in different ways than other devices. In an interview with Security Fix, Polonensky says that the utilities have adopted the stance that existing regulations already prevent them from sharing customer data without prior authorization. But he noted that the power companies transition to the smart grid, those utilities are going to be collecting and potentially retaining orders of magnitude more data on their customers than ever before. Relatively speaking, utilities aren't big marketing companies with big back-end databases ready to handle the tidal wave of data that's coming. But we're a little worried that without some serious planning now, there's going to be quite a challenge in a couple years when people start realizing that maybe they should think about deploying some solid data retention policies that address what's going to be done with all this data. Indeed, the report found the comprehensive and consistent definitions of personally identifiable information do not generally exist in the utility industry. Privacy concerns arise when there's a possibility of discovering personal information, such as personal habits, behaviors, and lifestyles of individuals inside dwellings, and to use this information for secondary purposes, other than that for provision of electricity. Ontario is on track to have a smart meter installed at every home and business by the end of 2010. More than 8 million smart meters are in use in the United States today, and more than 50 million could be installed in at least two dozen states over the next 5 years, according to Edison Foundation's Institute for Electrical Efficiency. The report echoes some of the same concerns raised in a recent report drafted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which warned that distributed energy resource and smart meters will reveal information about residential customers and activities within the house. ANIST panel tasked with the examining of cybersecurity aspects of the smart grid found a lack of formal privacy policies, standards, or procedures about information gathered and collected by entities involved in the smart grid, and that comprehensive and consistent definitions of personally identified information do not generally exist in the utility industry. Well, it doesn't exist because it was never there before. And as these private power companies come on board with these data collection facilities and are able to drill down and look at patterns, because each different type of appliance is going to show a different type of pattern of usage. Say if your fridge goes on and off every 10 minutes or every hour, it's going to show a pattern. And that's going to be a pattern that's not going to identify somebody in a house. But somebody who turns on a washing machine where it goes through a different load cycle and uses different amounts of electricity is going to show up, and that's going to imply that they're doing the laundry. And this is perfect for marketing groups that want to know this information so that they can do better marketing research and provide targeted advertising for customers. And also, if this falls into the wrong hands, as data often does, if it's not properly secured, this can also be used for, you know, showing when people are home or not. And you could target a whole blocks of residences based on times when people are home during the week. Or you could see when somebody's on vacation based on loads of what's happening in their house, whether TVs are coming on or off, whether lights are going on or off. Now, are we going to have to, in the future, protect ourselves by generating false loads on our equipment so that and incurring costs to us so that these data collections are errant? Just like those little cards that are handed out in the grocery stores. I've heard at places, you know, when you go to a grocery store and you get the loyalty card and you swipe it through, you get points. And I've been to conferences, hacking conferences, where people trade these cards back and forth all over the country, and just to mess with the data collection. And I think that's hilarious. But are we going to have to extend this and move this kind of technology into our home to throw off possible data breaches and invasion of privacy by private corporations gleaning and selling this data off of our personal information that exposes a little bit more of our habits than we may want to? And in Pirate Party news, I'd like to say congratulations to the Pirate Party of Canada for collecting the number of signatures that they need to apply as a Canadian political party. And if you want to get more info on that, especially if you live in Canada and you'd like to sign up, go to pirateparty.ca. And now the closing track this week I'll leave you with is some words from a website called .rights.org. And it's based in Northern California, but it's the words are quite applicable to the rest of the country and the world. And it's at www.rights.org. Kind of weird. But you'll see it in my forum post, and you can get to it from there. And if you have any news stories or comments or anything you'd like to pass along to me, or things you'd like to hear on the show, submit them through the form on the website at pirateparty.radio.com. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Did you know that everything you do online leaves a trail of personal information behind? Your photos? Tagged. What you read or watch, logged. Your searches, saved. And your friend lists, collected. Ever wonder why? Or what can happen to all that personal info when you log off? You might think your photos, search histories, and friend lists are worthless to anyone but you, but you're so wrong. Companies collect info about who you are, where you go, what you do, and who you know, because it's very valuable. Companies use this online trail to build a detailed profile of you. It's a great way to send you ads they think you'll like or sell your info to other companies. But have any idea what's in your profile, where it goes, or how it could be used or abused? Because it's not just companies that like to get their hands on your info. The government wants it too. They buy it from data brokers. Or take advantage of very outdated privacy laws to demand it with a subpoena that a judge has never seen. Sometimes they just ask nicely and companies give it to them. They don't need any proof that you've done anything wrong. They can just scoop up your info now and sort it all out later. And what happens when the government sorts it all out? Kids end up on the no-fly list. Political groups get infiltrated. Driver's licenses, loans, and jobs are unfairly denied. And what about the online trail you leave behind every day? How could info about you, where you go, what you do, or who you know get used or abused? No one should make you choose between using cool new sites and keeping your private information safe from a snooping government. It's time to take back control of your personal information. Demand a privacy upgrade. Demand your dot rights.